camps, this is the basis on which capitalism is going to generate societies we can accept? No. And I don't believe that any of us has all the solutions. That's just infantile. What we do have is a responsibility. If we don't say, how do you generate jobs? If we're going to ride the wave of the green economy, which we have to, there are no jobs on a dead planet. How's that for reform, Ben? We want the green economy. We want investment and innovation that comes from it. You know, Germany has created the single biggest industry policy. Now, I know the Americans don't like talking about industry policy. We quite like it in Australia, much smaller market. But industry policy, for any other term you can put on it, in Germany, has been created by a political decision forced by people. No more nuclear energy, be for it or against it, doesn't matter. It will generate billions of dollars into innovation, new export products. It will keep Germany's export kingmanship alive for decades to come. But you've got to invest. And it's not, I'm not saying again, it's all government investment. On the contrary, with the balance sheet sitting in corporations, we can do a lot. The green, the climate tax, fought by corporations everywhere in Australia, particularly the resource sector. But in fact, that will do more to generate the 2 to 3%, and that's our demand for Davos. 2 to 3% of investment in jobs, in the productive economy, in the real economy, with employers and unions and government actually sitting at the table. And it doesn't have to be government expenditure. On the contrary, it can facilitate unleashing the talents of and the wealth of corporations. But what about also the informal economy? If we're talking about entrepreneurism, all we're doing with this model is actually shoving economies, including the developed world, into the informal sector. People are desperate to survive. So you've got an informal economy, some of it shadow economy in the developed world, but you've got between 30 and 90%, depending on the developed or the developing world. How can capitalism sustain itself if it's not formalised?
I agree we should have this forum next year in Australia, because obviously there are a lot of good answers there.
I actually live in Belgium these days, but...
Oh, okay. We'll do it there, too.
I was the Australian
Labor League. I have a million and one questions that I could continue to ask. Raghu's been waiting patiently for her response, and then I'm going to open it up to the floor to questions. So if you want to start thinking about what you want to ask now, Raghu, did you have a...
Well, just that ultimately, if you boil down capitalism to its roots, it's about paying people the marginal product of their wages. And you can rail about that all you want, but if the marginal product of people's work is less than the wages you propose to pay them, firms make losses and ultimately can't employ those workers. So the critical question we have here is, how do we increase the marginal product? That's the way to get wages up. And how do you do that in the industrial world? That's the debate we should be having. By all means, we can transfer, we can raise the minimum wage, et cetera. But if that exceeds the marginal product, you're essentially driving firms into penury. So I think the right debate is, how do we get the innovation? How do we get the productivity? How do we get the job creation as a result of that?
Not and how do you distribute the profits?
Eventually, those profits will get distributed. But sure, there's a margin that you can distribute. But you can't distribute more than the marginal product of somebody's labor. Ultimately, they have to be productive citizens.
It's called bargaining.
No, by all means, bargaining takes place. But all I'm saying is, you cannot legislate a minimum wage which is more than what a person is producing.
And let's put the facts on the table. We are all involved as labour leaders in either advocating or bargaining for both minimum wages and collective agreements. And you cannot bargain more than you can afford. So I'm on your table about that. But come on, the wealthiest country in the world, where people have to borrow to actually pay for groceries, can't afford more than $7.20 an hour. It's not helping capitalism because they don't have the money to buy the product, but it's actually leaving people impoverished.
But, now, again, you're switching to affordability rather than productivity.
Well,
right?
No, I mean for both. Let's get the productivity, but I can show you the productivity figures and what makes it grow and what makes it collapse. And we can show you what's happened to demand. You're all suffering from a lack of demand. Yet no one wants to talk about wages. Why? Because it might just take a sliver off the profits that have been exorbitant in the major companies. Now, for small to medium companies, it's absolutely a balancing act, and you have to bargain your way through all of those factors: productivity, innovation, skills, and indeed the productive wealth distribution of wages after that. So anyone who wants to put us in a camp and say, well, they're over here, they're against capitalism, they want to break the bank, that's not true. What we want, though, is a sense of the fair go all round. And right now, there are corporations that are way too big with way too much power, and it is about that global reach. I'm actually certainly not against globalisation. That's my job. And we believe in everybody having a chance at development. But if you have global corporations that cannot buy and sell governments effectively now, you're right. The model needs to be re-looked at.
David, did you want to cap things off? Then we are going to move to the floor.
My main point is, well, first, if the minimum wage were increasing in the United States, that'd be fine with me. I just don't think it'll solve all our economic problems. Our economic problems are very deep because of the debt and the deficit and other things. I think we've got about 3 to 4 years in the West to improve the economic model we have. And if we don't do that soon, I think that we've lost the game in competing against emerging market capitalism or state capitalism, because I think they just have a more efficient model right now, which is going to take a lot of jobs away from the West. So I think we've got to work through these problems. If we don't do it in 3 or 4 years, when we have this kind of session 3 or 4 years from now, the game will be over for the type of capitalism that many of us have lived through and thought was the best type of capitalism.
Okay, we're going to reward the front row here. So we're going to go 1, 2, and then in the back there. So we'll do the first 3 this way.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Jarvis. I found this to be incredibly frustrating. For what I've found is the institutions of the economy, corporation, equity, unions, banks, universities, taking zero responsibility for the state that we're in. And you're right, looking nostalgically at some past that is now completely gone. The people who are not here among the disrupted are the disruptors. The entrepreneurs, technologists, and young people who are creating that future and that next economy, the economy we should be talking about. So I'm going to ask them what the economy is. And I'd like to compare that with what you think the future economy is, because I haven't heard a single thing today, not only about responsibility for the past or vision for the future, somewhat from you, Mr. Mahan, but otherwise I've heard no vision, just a lot of nostalgic debate by the old institutions that frankly deserve to be disrupted.
We spend
it's very difficult in an hour and a half or hour and 15 minutes with 5 people to give somebody the complete view of how the world is going to change in the future and how we can make the world better. So I apologize that we didn't make it more interesting, but next year you can be on the panel and I can sit there and I can tell you that I'd like to hear different answers. It's not that easy to encapsulate all of the world's wisdom in an hour and 15 minutes, but you do make some very good points. Clearly, many of the people who are changing the world are not on this panel. Many of the people are young people, and many of the people who lead the social networking revolution are not on this panel. Clearly, over the next 5 or 10 years, the social networkers, the people who are communicating with each other through that mechanism, and the disruptors are going to be the people that change the world. What we've learned over the last 100 years or so is you're never able to predict who is going to make these changes and how the disruption is going to occur. People in our large kind of organizations we are not generally the disruptors. The disruptors are people who are entrepreneurs, small organizations that we haven't heard of today. So 5 years from today, none of us probably would be invited back, and different people will be up here because we will have been disrupted out of our positions.
We don't have 5 years to not be asked back. But there's 2 things. First of all those people that you want to talk to are here in Davos. So, I mean, it's not that the WEF hasn't organized for it. You have the 20-year-olds, you have the 30-year-olds, you have the new entrepreneurs. Second, I mean, your last sentence was a great sentence listening to the applause, but I would think twice before you get what you wished for. Because disruption is great, but you said destroy what we have. I'm not so sure that you will live with the consequences, but, be my guest.
But he didn't say destruction. He said disruption. And I think that's right. I think that is a really valid debate. It wasn't the one we were posed with. But I actually think it's a really valid debate. How do institutions evolve, reset, redesign themselves for a 21st century that will be very different? I mean, if we don't see the political courage to tackle the climate challenge, then, this is all pretty irrelevant for our kids and grandkids, frankly. They're pretty frustrated with us. So if we don't see the capacity to do something genuinely about people to lift them out of poverty so we end civil wars, then the disruption to the old institutions will happen anyway. And it's the same for us. I don't think unionism is the same brand of product. You certainly wouldn't have seen a woman global leader, 20 years ago, let alone 50 or 70 years ago, and you wouldn't have seen women's participation. You wouldn't have seen, despite what Ben says, young people arguing for different models, but some of them back to the future too, cooperatives, you know, working together, networking, social networking across barriers that once they physically networked around in a shared wealth production environment. So I think your premise is a very good one. Sadly, it wasn't quite the debate we were posed with.
Anyone else? Go ahead.
I mean, I think there is a very real problem for the young today, and I think you can see it across countries. 40% unemployment in Spain, 45 in Greece, largely concentrated amongst the youth. And I think the point you raise about the future being important, about visualizing it in a way that these people have a chance, I think that is the central question, the central threat to some extent to the capitalist system. If you don't draw people along, they are going to disrupt it. They are going to fight up, not in the innovative way you're talking about, but in just overthrowing the institutions and perhaps trying to get a new set. Who knows what that might be? So I think it's extremely important we solve these problems. It may be that some of the solutions are the plain, boring ones that we've been talking about, rather than some innovations that we haven't anticipated as yet. But who knows? It's probably a mix of both.
Brian, you want to make it 5 for 5, or are you good where it stands?
Inside large organizations, disruption goes on every day. So at the one hand, we have branches. The other hand, we have 9 million mobile banking customers. And the people who fund that help fund all that entrepreneurial society out there, but also do it inside. So one of the challenges running large organizations is how do you refresh and do that? And that really goes down to the question of talented people and treat them well and give them the spirit. So we have people who look like what you're posturing, and we have people who look like me and everything in between. And our job is to hustle that, both internally and externally, for the benefit of our customers. And so I think these premises that get thrown out, large companies aren't innovative. The premises that get thrown out that, you know, that the big companies are, we've got to think that through, and that's the thing we need to think about, because the largeness is here and inevitable because economies are globalizing. The question is, how do we make the jobs? How do we make the fairness? How do we make the things? Second point is, you've heard me say it before here, you hear me say, the people who run the institutions that you don't think take both very seriously the issues in the past, we absolutely do. And you should rest assured that. How we run our institutions is so different than we ran them a few years ago, even if the people are sick. So that's not an acknowledgement. We're trying to move forward, though, and we know that, and we've learned from it. So don't ever, in my mind, ever discount the fact that we don't wear the scars still today, and we'll continue to wear them for the rest of our careers, and we understand that. Will we get it right next time? God only knows. We can't predict the future, but we all understand that. What we're trying to do is move forward to where the puck is going, as opposed to where it's been. And that innovation, all the stuff you're talking about, it doesn't mean we don't remember what happened, believe me.
Another frustration is that we've all spent many years of our life trying to get to the point where we get invited to be in this panel, and now somebody wants to disrupt us out of this, but okay.
Yeah. So the gentleman who has the microphone now, and then the gentleman in the back after.
Okay, hi, I'm Mohammed Al-Haw. I'm a part of the Global Shapers community, and I'm from Egypt. I have a question. We no longer live in the industrial age, and everyone acknowledges this. Why are we insisting on managing it in the same old manner? I don't know if the new name is capitalism or something else, but what I care about, how can we have a practice that ensures a platform for young people to create these jobs? So instead of we creating the job for the younger or all that sort of things, how can we create a platform that enables the young to create jobs for themselves and for others? Because it's about talent, and if we enable that talent to do that, then maybe that's the solution. So what is the system, what is the practice that can enable such platform? It's a question to the panel.
Can I just both support that and challenge it? Like, absolutely, we need the young entrepreneurs, and they are going to create, you know, new companies we haven't dreamed about yet, and they should be supported. But don't dismiss what you call the old industrial age, you know, call it what you like. We have to produce twice as much food by 2050 as we do now, some people say three times, on less arable land. That is about innovation, but it's also about production, traditional production. So we have to get that right, and that requires a sharing around the globe. If you were, you know, a slightly younger Labor leader like me in the early 90s, and we heard that, you know, the technology was going to change the face. There were going to be not these old, dirty jobs. It was going to be a whole new world based on skills and talent. And I'm a teacher by trade and have spent my life in the skills sector, so I'm passionate about talent. But we heard, you know, you need to all go in and be computer programmers and so on and so forth. What we used to say is, look, that's really important, and we need those people, and particularly the young minds. But they're going to graft their knowledge on traditional industries, to mining, to manufacturing, to agriculture. And now I say to people when they say, well, the green economy, you know, there's going to be no more traditional industry. Well, you can't actually build six-star buildings without aluminium, cement and steel, at least today. Now, what you will do is have to graft new technologies and new production cycles. So I hate it, frankly, when people pit each other against one another. It isn't about whether or not you should be supported. Of course you should. Platforms should be there, the skills, the investment in education, which we've sadly dropped off, and it's the biggest productivity figure we could deliver to the world. But also, let's look at how we actually shore up the best of the traditional world we know that's going to be required for the next at least 50 or 100 years. And where does the innovation replace that? You know, manufacturing always amazes me. People say, oh, you know, dirty manufacturing is dead. Well, to some extent it is. Even in the raw material sector, you go into a pot smelter now or a foundry, and frankly, you will find computers dominate most of the work. But in fact, biomanufacturing is simply a translation of product or packaging or whatever it is into new products that are more sustainable. So that's where we need the innovation. But the workers will still be there, along with the technology and along with the new industries you're going to create off the back of that innovation.
So one of the principal changes in the last 10 years in the way society operates in the West, at least, and I think all over the world, is that the people who rise to the top of these large organizations, business, labor, whatever it might be, are now looking over their shoulders and saying, what are the innovations of the future that I need to adapt to? And those innovations are going to come from young people. So increasingly, large organizations are saying, tell me who the young people are, who are our customers, what are our young people who are employees doing? What are our young people doing in terms of changing technology? So much greater than 50 years ago, these large organizations are now saying, tell us what the young people want to do. And this World Economic Forum is adapting to that to some extent as well. It used to be that everybody was invited to the World Economic Forum, and we were called whatever we were called. Then they came up with young global leaders, and you had to be under 40 for that. Now they have a new thing called New Shakers, which are people under 30. And probably next year they'll have something under 20. And the people like us are the old shakers, I think, because we, you know, are not that robust anymore. But clearly the World Economic Forum, I think, recognizes this. And I think all corporations and unions and other organizations recognize that change is coming from people who are your age. And we are much more focused on your thoughts than we ever were.
Ben, did you have one capstone, and then we need to move on? We only have about five more minutes.
I have one line. You come from Egypt. I think you don't have to wait for permission. And there's one thing that I think that is really the big change. In maybe in the past, it was asking, give me the platform, give me the tools. Today, it's just doing.
Which is what the free enterprise system is about, right? You don't have to ask permission. It creates competition, and you go out and build your enterprise and you compete with the big guys. The places where we have tremendous youth unemployment, Spain, Greece, are places where the free enterprise system is not working as it should. Too many of the services are clogged up because the incumbents are protected. That's what, in some sense, we need to change to give the youth a chance.
Do we have another question there in the back?
And then we'll come over here. I'm Joe Schoendorf. I am a partner with Accel Partners in Silicon Valley. I've spent 45 years there, the last 25 in venture. I don't like to say that venture capitalists create jobs. We don't. We provide money, and we provide mentoring, and we make a bet, we pick somebody, and we get behind them. A big issue has not been discussed up here. We're one of, you know, a couple of hundred venture firms. You go on our website today, accel.com, we probably have 100 active companies that we have provided the funding and the mentoring for over the last 3 to 5 years. We post the jobs for all of those companies. I looked this morning, 1,577 jobs open, many of them paying six figures, most of them needing a degree of education and training that is in short supply in the United States. Now, we get into a political issue. We said, all right, give us green cards. We need to bring in engineers from other places. It got stopped in the U.S. political system. But for that engineer who doesn't get hired, you all run companies with technical people. That's probably five or six other people who aren't getting hired that would get hired to support that engineer. And this is a real problem. If I'm one venture firm, and I probably invest in what, David, you'd say, you know, 0.1% or 1% of the market, and I've got 100 companies and I've got 1,577 jobs, and most of them, you know, way, 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 way above minimum wage, many of them in six figures. And we've got a problem where our government is basically preventing the creation of those jobs, and we've got a training issue. We've got $1 trillion in U.S. debt for people who have paid for college educations, getting degrees where, one, they could be employed in this world if we had more engineers, or they should have gone out and tried to do something in the math and sciences. Big companies, the disruption rate of big companies is about to increase. We're going to lose a global brand this year. I mean, you all bought a Kodak film at some point in your life. The story you may not know is Kodak invented the digital camera. 1975, 0.1 megapixel. They took it to the board. The board said, good idea, but please don't tell anybody about this.
So that's true. We talked a lot about competitiveness, but we didn't really, and we even might have mentioned training, but we didn't use the word education, I don't think, once. Well, that's a good point.
Well, one of the scandals of the world and the undermining of productivity is the lack of investment in education and training. No question. But I want to also say that the venture capital model that you just heard describes, not all like that, but is absolutely important to think through. What do? They actually support someone and they mentor them and they get those startup companies to a point where they are self-sustaining. That is really good work because they create jobs, you're right, most of them are good jobs, etc. And I want to say that for the labour movement, part of what we bring to the table is $25 trillion of workers' capital, our pension funds, and $14 trillion of them are co-managed by labour leaders and business leaders. And that is part of lifting the burden of government debt and indeed, of course, of creating productive investment.
If we have more comments on this particular question, I'm afraid this is probably where we're going to have to leave it. So I'm sorry we won't have time for any more questions. And once we cap this out, we're going to have to end the session.
Joe, it was too nice to he's in a quiet period, but one of his companies they invested in was a company called, you would have heard of Facebook. I think you've heard of that.
Just a small one.
I'm sorry, Ragi, did you?
On the issue of education, I mean, that's clearly something that's very important. But of course, there's education and there's education. There's some education which doesn't get you anything in the workforce, doesn't get you any pay, and there's some education, science, technology, engineering, math, which is very crucial in the United States, very important, and we need more of that. It's easier said than done. I think changing education has been on every president's agenda since Gerald Ford, and we haven't really made an impact. I think it is something that we have to take a very close look at. I think President Obama is looking at it. But it is something that there is a lot of resistance to change from within the education industry. I belong to that industry. We would like to do more. We should do more. And hopefully we can do more. But it is clearly, in many ways, the central problem that we face.
You know, one of the points that has been raised recently that's of concern to me in the Western publications is that education is not a good thing. Increasingly, people are saying you don't need to get a college degree and you can do just as well without it. I think that is a very, very misleading thing, and if people believe that, they're going to be very disappointed. The better educated you are, the better you're going to be prepared for the 21st century, whatever form of capitalism we have.
I think people confuse education and training, and those are two different concepts. And
but they're both important.
They're both important, but they're two different concepts.
And so, affirming the importance of education, I think that we're going to have to end it here. I want to thank the panelists for an incredibly engaging debate, which I think sets the tone for the rest of the week. I want to thank the audience on behalf of Time and World Economic Forum. Thank you, everyone. Please enjoy the rest of your week.